evening. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. This is tape number 354, and it is September the 15th, 1978. For those of you that subscribe regularly to these tapes, I will be giving them a date and just one number instead of numbering on both sides and giving it a different number from now on. Tape last week was 353 on both sides, and we go to 354, and it's just a little technicality, but we'll give one number for each tape, and you can refer to side one and two. There are many quotations to the effect that if we don't study the history, we're likely to repeat this. Santa Anna's quotation is the most often used, and I don't like to use it verbatim because it just seems to roll off our tongues like the Pledge of Allegiance without really saying it differently each time with the same intent, that those who do not study the past are really jeopardized into understanding their own times, because our own times are a succession of what preceded us, and our future is no better than what we do with it today based upon our experiences of the past. One of the finest books about the past available is a book called Inspection for Disarmament by Seymour Melman. Inspection for Disarmament was published in 1958 by Columbia University Press, and the chapter that is particularly important in that book is by E.J. Gumbel, a professor from Heidelberg University who had been fired by Adolf Hitler. He was written up in Time magazine just prior to the election of Adolf Hitler in 1933, and that he had made a remark in the university putting down the erecting of monuments of war heroes. He didn't give much credence to warriors, and he was fired from the university and I guess left Europe and came to the United States. And in this book, the essay by E.J. Gumbel, they repeated the research that he did on what were 400 assassinations of foes of Adolf Hitler and the National Christian Party that preceded Adolf Hitler coming into power. And in conjunction with the political assassinations, I quote from the book because it's so terribly important to Evel Younger and the House Select Committee and the courts, the Warren Commission courts, and what has happened in the United States, whether it's the Kent State or the Manson trial or the SLA case, the role of the law courts. This is a quotation from the book, and it says, "The role of the law courts made all of these political assassinations possible. The political assassinations were committed by secret armies who put a heavy burden on the administration of justice. The murderers had to be acquitted, or later in our case, they were killed or became patsies, and the victims had to be shown as guilty." And I refer to people such as Lee Harvey Oswald, James Earl Ray, Sirhan Sirhan. In quotes, "The military courts were set up which sided with the military men." In this case, I give the example of William Blakey, who tells the House Select Committee on television, "We have objective witnesses," and then when they're through, they thank the Army for their leaves. A Dr. Vincent Gwynne is described in the newspaper, the recent meetings of the House Select Committee, as a, quotes, "a professor from Irvine College," yet he testified that he was from NASA and the Atomic Energy. In Germany, the military took care of the courts, the defense lawyers, and also the trial judges. Mr. Gumbel said, in quotes, "there was no proof of illegal activities that was allowed to be admitted into the court. No proof of the illegal activity was admitted in courts, and by this procedure, the Supreme Court could affirm that there were no conspiracies and they didn't exist. And in order to assure sentences, officers of the military government were called as the witnesses for the prosecution." Mr. Gumbel said the courts were manipulated by the inability to find the guilty and by issuing false papers of identity by the police department for these various people. This reminds me of when James Earl Ray left the prison. The warden didn't give any alert that he had gone for 24 hours. When they were looking for an Eric Gault, the former prison officials and the police in Memphis, Tennessee, didn't have the fingerprints of James Earl Ray. They'd given the wrong fingerprints. Meanwhile, he had left prison with the false identity papers of a Mr. Raines. And then, of course, he had a car and license and identity of Eric Starbo Gault and Mr. Bridgman and Mr. Sneed and a lot of other people. He had these false identities. So this was the way the courts were manipulated in Nazi Germany. And if you study that and you study Mr. Gumbel's essay and research on that period, you can transpose it to what's happening in the United States. And it was only after I began to study the courts in the United States, the Warren Commission and the assassination of Robert Kennedy and the various Martin Luther King, the various violences, particularly in California, that it became necessary to go further to study history because none of this was making any sense. There is a book that I bought several years ago, published. It's the title of the book is Anti-California, Report from Our First Parafascist State by Kenneth Lamott, L-A-M-O-T-T. And I'm just going to give you the references on the printed sheet if you want to get access to this book. It first came out in 1963, and this was before the fascism was really coming down in this state. And in succeeding years, it's been republished. The last date on it is 1971. It was published by Little Brown and Company, Anti-California, Report from Our First Parafascist State. And what the introduction to this book explains, and I'm going to just read you a few pages because if you're interested, you can look it up. He said, I tried earnestly to avoid using the word fascism in the title of this book. It's an emotional word, an inflammatory word. Fascism is an irreplaceable word conveying a sense of the methodical corruption of public life as well as the destruction of private lives. Yet there is clearly a difference of kind and of degree between Germany in 1930 and 40 and California in 1960 and 70. We look around for stormtroopers. Instead, we see Hell's Angels and Birchers and hard hats. We wait for Mussolini and Hitler, and we get Ronald Reagan. Fascism to California is coming at all levels, and while the Birchers are not enforcing Nuremberg laws and the Hell's Angels are not operating death camps, yet, he says, there is something not entirely unfamiliar about what is going on in the United States and what is going on in California. California is the distant warning system for the rest of the United States. California is our window to the future. California is the center of the whirlpool where all the currents come to focus. Reports from California are the minutes of the next meeting. And what you see here is the disintegration of a state, the corruption of a promised land, what should have been the brightest and the best. According to Kenneth Lamott, he said, California is governed by charismatic buffoons who are not reluctant to use their tremendous power. One-third of the people depend upon the daily bread for the production of bombs, missiles, napalms, and every other obscene item found in the modern catalog of death. In California, war is literally the health of the state. We are engaged in open warfare against an eternal enemy who is often described in terms that would have instructed Goebbels. And the enemy, of course, is our own young people. Our universities and colleges are being manipulated. Technology has triumphed. It is the index of private distress, suicide, drugs, alcohol, meaningless sexual activity. It is a racist state with deliberate subjugation of Native Indians, the Chicanos, the Mexican Americans. There is moral apathy in California, and this I can guarantee. There is moral apathy. He goes into the Chicanos, who more than a century have been California's largest suppressed minority, are finally becoming visible thanks to Cesar Chavez. In the case of the blacks, because of tragedies and riots and the murder of Ruben Salazar by the Los Angeles Police Department, he says the spokesmen also here are being eliminated. This book goes into some of the fascists of California. He names a few of them from Berkeley and throughout the state. And it gives you a background of what this man fears in the comparison of what he sees coming as towards Nazi Germany. Now, this tape is not just a tirade against Evel Younger. It is particularly against Younger. But I have no love for the position of our Governor Brown, and I want you to know in an election year what I feel about Governor Brown. I don't know how much he's controlled by his father. Jerry Brown was put in as a Democratic candidate. His father was a governor before. He lost the election to Ronald Reagan. He has a law office in Beverly Hills. A member of his law office is Joseph Ball of the Warren Commission. He was John Ehrlichman's attorney at the time of Watergate for burglarizing Dr. Lewis Fielding's offices in Beverly Hills. Joseph Ball and any member of the Warren Commission belongs to what I call the killer team. If they didn't plan the killings, they covered them up. And he is in the law office of the former Governor Brown. Another member to join that law office just last week is Herbert Kalmbach, another member of the killer team, lawyer for United Airlines, who covered up that fatal plane crash of Dorothy Hunt, the Watergate bag woman carrying money at the time that they were trying to hide Herbert Kalmbach's connections to the secret funding. He took Martha Mitchell to a hospital using a name as if she was his wife, didn't give them her name. She was injected, died 3 years later of cancer, was kept a prisoner. Herbert Kalmbach was part of the inner secret team of clandestine activities, along with the Martha Mitchell fatal death and Dorothy Hunt's fatal, all deaths are fatal, but I mean the manipulation of these women and the role that Herbert Kalmbach had in the inner secret monies. He ends up in the law offices of the father of our governor. Now, that doesn't mean to cast aspersions on Jerry Brown necessarily. I have a father who's politically conservative and a friend of Richard Nixon's and a lot of the extreme right wing, close with Evel Younger, Ed Davis, and the whole gang. That doesn't mean that I think like him. I think differently. I am not controlled by his ideas. I am free thinking. The only thing I know is that when Governor Brown became the governor, he took Raymond Pecunier, who was the chief of the prison system, who started the riots and worked with the LAPD, started the riots in the sense that there was hard evidence that the gun that was brought in that killed George Jackson and that painful San Quentin 6 trial was instigated by the Los Angeles Police Department criminal conspiracy section set up by Evel Younger. Raymond Pecunier was in on the murder of the black prisoners in Soledad, the shootout of Jonathan Jackson, and Raymond Pecunier should have been removed from any office, and yet Governor Brown took him under his wing and gave him a very important job, even though the bulk of the violence at the California prisons was set up by Raymond Pecunier. So the office of Jerry Brown's father is tainted with Joseph Ball and now Herbert Kalmbach, a Republican of the first order with money for Richard Nixon and company, now working in this Democratic office, which reminds me of the switch of John Conley to the Republican Party, from the Democrats to the Republicans. And all I say is I don't know what taint they have on Jerry Brown, except that Jerry Brown on his own has people like Raymond Pecunier working for him, where the past efforts that this man has, he should have been removed from office. So even at best, he hires people that are not great. Now, this tape isn't about Jerry Brown. It's about Evel Younger. But I do want to tell you that it isn't clear-cut on either side. I don't think we have elections with choices. They're so much alike that I think you vote for the lesser of two evils. And in this case, I really can't think of anything more evil in operation, in links to the Central Intelligence Agency, to the Pentagon. He's a current general at this time, and was a district attorney in Los Angeles when Robert Kennedy was assassinated, and now wants to be the governor. And because this state has all the earmarks of everything but the goose steps, I do want to devote the time to Evel Younger and the reasons why I fear this man and why it should be a sensational story for any single thing that he's done, and yet the entire state just sleeps on it as if he were a little pussycat and a mild little man that nobody knows anything about. It's hard to put into any chronological order what's wrong with Evel Younger in my mind, because you could just take, I have maybe 80 articles here and 80 things that he's involved in, enough to have written a book about him, I suppose, or maybe I still could. But there's no chronological order in my feelings towards them or what I'm going to tell you. I'll just take what I have here and as much as we have time for. The first time I ever really became familiar with his name is being of interest to me, because I'd been studying the John Kennedy assassination for 4 years, was in the time that Robert Kennedy was killed, and Evel Younger was going to investigate the Robert Kennedy assassinations. In July of 1968, Robert Kennedy was killed in June, Evel Younger had a large article in the Los Angeles Times, July 14th, 1968. It's a collector's item for those of you that want it. It said, 23-man task force selected to probe Kennedy's murder. A select team of Los Angeles policemen, each handpicked for his specialty skills, will go into the murder of Robert Kennedy. A 23 task force headed by Captain Hugh Brown, a police homicide, will do the investigative work. The boss is Younger's top aide, Chief Deputy District Attorney Lynn J. Compton, one-time UCLA football hero and a conscientious prosecutor, and no stones would be left unturned by U.S. Attorney Matt Byrne and Deputy Police Chief Robert Houghton. They would draw from all their resources into the fatal murder of Robert Kennedy. And Younger said, in quotes, no lead, no piece of evidence, no matter how kooky, will be overlooked. If there are 10,000 leads, and we checked out 9,999 and let another one go, someone would write a book accusing us of covering up something. Unimportant leads that might be ignored in cases otherwise checked. So we don't want another New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison, that type of person, to come in 4 years later and say, we didn't do this and we didn't do that, and we are aware that the whole nation, the whole world is watching. So I wrote a letter in 1968. I had written to Evel Younger and the office. Dear Mr. Younger, I had stated I have done research on the Kennedy assassination for 4 years. I've contacted Sergeant Paget and Sergeant Collins, and I would like to come down and give information to them about the links of the Sirhan family into the CIA, and you've said that you'll see everybody, and I want to come to your office and give you the information about the investigation that you're going to be doing. I got a telephone call back July 26, 1968, Friday at 1:40 p.m. from a Sergeant Miller. And he said, are you Magnon Brussel? My name was Mae Brussel, and they had my middle name there. They said, would you give us your height? How much do you weigh? What color is your hair? And what is your nationality? And that is the last I ever heard of the investigators of the Robert Kennedy assassination. The entire state of California has been one scene of violence and murders against witnesses and crimes. I just can't emphasize enough, so much like Nazi Germany, that I'll just give you a few examples. In the newspapers in February of 1972, there were articles by Frank Martinez, a man that worked for Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, that the Sheriff Peter Pitches and the Los Angeles Police Department were out against the Mexican-Americans. I have an article, Los Angeles Police versus Mexican-Americans. And they charge in quotes that there was a police state at that time. A David Aguayo, 16 years old, had been hit in the head. But there was the Chicano moratorium with shootouts by the police into the crowd. That's when Ruben Salazar was murdered, the newspaper man who had come home from Vietnam. There were charges of the law enforcement when Evel Younger was the district attorney down there of this violence in the Los Angeles area. Now, an assemblyman in Sacramento started to look into these matters. His name is Robert Crown. He represented Alameda County, a member of the California Assembly. And the articles I have in 1972 is that he was looking into the police brutality and the charges of a police state down in the Southern California area. Robert Crown was very important because he was on the Criminal Justice Committee, also in Sacramento, and had the deciding vote on the death penalty. Evel Younger was pushing the death penalty, was and is, and the people that he would kill, that he had on his list were Sirhan Sirhan and Charles Manson, and I felt that they should be preserved. First of all, I don't believe in the death penalty, but all victims of political assassinations, of killing political persons, should be preserved and deprogrammed by a series of doctors and not killed, because as soon as you kill them, you lose the chain of command. If there's a political assassination that changes the entire political structure in Saudi Arabia, the nephew has his head cut off the next day. That's one sure way of not knowing whether, in fact, the acid he got in Berkeley caused him to kill his uncle or not, or whether the oil prices increased the day after this kid's head was cut off and the profits went into the Saudi Arabian oil very quickly. Robert Crown was looking into the matters of the charges of police state. He was run over by a car. He was jogging up in his hometown. For all purposes, I never could get a police report on who ran over him or that anyone was charged or fined. And his crucial vote was then delayed on the death penalty issue and his work, of course, on the police state charges in Los Angeles never came to any results. Another person that worked down in the Los Angeles Police Department who was important to the murders of blacks and Mexican-Americans or public official cover-ups was a coroner by the name of Donald Angus Stewart, S-T-U-A-R-T. And you can get the Los Angeles Times, April 14, 1971. Coroner Stewart came in and he said that he was a doctor. He'd come from Canada and the Midwest. I have a list of all the various places he came from. And every time these blacks and Chicanos were dying, it was called justifiable homicide. And Thomas Noguchi, the coroner there, challenged Dr. Stewart. And one of the things that Dr. Stewart had done as deputy coroner was try to get Thomas Noguchi fired. Some of you don't remember this story. He was the coroner who said that the shot that killed Robert Kennedy, the fatal shot, was 1 inch behind the head. The burns and the direction of the shot was a downward up in the autopsy, 1 inch from the head. And of course, Sirhan Sirhan was in front of Robert Kennedy and not behind him and never had a gun 1 inch from his head. But a gentleman from Lockheed named Thane Caesar did have a gun, and he did fall to the floor, and he admitted he fired the gun, and he was the security guard right behind Robert Kennedy, and the autopsy of Thomas Noguchi would negate the findings that the official police report of Evel Younger had on the assassination of Robert Kennedy. So the result was that they tried very hard to fire Thomas Noguchi, and they had a long list of charges made up by this wonderful Donald Angus Stewart. Noguchi fought those charges one by one and stayed in. And then 3 years later, he found out that Dr. Stewart was not a doctor, that he had falsified his claims. He obviously came from a CIA agency or trained by the Defense Intelligence Agency to come in as a doctor into a coroner's office and allow these murders to be slipped by on paper as all justifiable until there were screams in the coroner's office and the police department to investigate the police and Sheriff Peter Pitches. And one of the men who let Coroner Donald Angus Stewart off, this is what he got. He let all these murders go by and tried to get Thomas Noguchi fired, and his penalty was that he was out on probation and fined only $300. And the statement was that he's out because there's no evidence that any harm was done. That is the most gross kind of court system down there, because the harm was done. The outright cold-blooded murders were done by law enforcement and were concealed. And this is, again, the comparison of Nazi Germany, where the military bring in their witnesses and judges. Now, this same U.S. attorney, Robert Meyer, that let Donald Stewart off the hook, got his in return. Later, he was investigating one of those exact murders that the Chicano group were claiming was a cold-blooded murder, Ruben Salazar. And he was also investigating, as U.S. attorney, the Isla Vista riots, because they seemed to be a agent provocateur riot, the same kind we got with Hitler's Reichstag to blame the students in Santa Barbara during the anti-war movement. And U.S. Attorney Robert Meyer got a telephone call from the assistant in the Justice Department and told him to stop those investigations. And he was fired on the spot. And he had a press conference that he was fired by the Justice Department in Washington for investigating the murders in California, the murders and riots, and in California. And he said that's the kiss of death to oppose these people. I called Robert Meyer and said, if they are doing these things and concealing it, I've worked on the Robert Kennedy case, would you help me? And of course he said, I'm going to law practice, private law practice, and I'm not interested. Later he revealed that the phone call he got from the Justice Department came from L. Patrick Gray, who then later became acting head of the FBI during Watergate. But after he gave the statement that to oppose John Mitchell and L. Patrick Gray back there was the kiss of death, he also was found dead right after that, within a short time, I have the dates, in a parking lot in Pasadena. So Robert Crown didn't live to continue his investigation of the police state in Los Angeles, and U.S. Robert Meyer never lived to investigate the Isla Vista riots and the killings of the Chicano moratorium down there and the Chicanos. And the beat goes on, and Evel Younger, and this is about Evel Younger, who had direct links to the White House, to the Pentagon, and the FBI. He is a general in the military. He has direct links to the Central Intelligence Agency and was and is working constantly with the FBI. He is the ultimate law enforcement man because of his links to the defense, the intelligence, and the police state network. The man that is running the campaign for Evel Younger, the funding of his campaign, is a man that Ken Reitz, R-E-I-T-Z, whose name should have made much more attention at the height of Watergate. You can find his name in the Washington Post, an article by Douglas Watson, June 7, 1973. Ken Reitz is putting up the money, as I say, running the campaign for Evel Younger right now. This is what the Washington Post says, that Reitz was a former partner in the campaign consultant firm of Allison and Trey Levin, and he worked for Congressman Mills, Congressman William O. Mills, who died in Maryland just at the time that his illegal money was exposed, linked to the Watergate White House money. Ken Reitz managed Mills' campaign in 1971, and that he delivered $25,000 in an envelope to James Webster, who was managing Mills' campaign. Shortly after that, Mr. Webster was killed in an automobile crash, and another man who received that money was killed in an automobile crash. And Congressman Mills, when the story came out about his links to Watergate, he died, and they said that he shot himself. It was a suicide at the time of Watergate, described as self-inflicted wounds, such as George DeMorenschild. Ken Reitz lives, but as I say, his campaign manager is dead. The two men who got the cash are dead, and in the Washington Post, they had an editorial that said, "Nevertheless, there is no getting around the fact that secrecy and cold cash, two elements running through the current national scandals, were involved in the Mills affair. The contribution to the Mills campaign was arranged by John Mitchell in the first instance during the Nixon campaign funds." And Congressman Mills, then, shortly after this came out, was found dead, and the two men who received this $25,000 are dead. But the man who gave them that money from the White House, from the secret intelligence money, was Ken Reitz, who is now funding the election campaign of Evel Younger. The importance of all of this is that in the state of Maryland, a lot of money was transacted and not accounted for, and the recipients, three known people, are dead. Yet at the time of Watergate, it turned out that there was a lot of money, more than this $25,000, a lot of thousands of dollars, I have the exact figure in one of the other files, to defeat Governor Wallace in his election. Now, Richard Nixon had told Governor Wallace not to run against him, but he wanted to run anyway against him. On the eve of his primary in Maryland and Michigan, George Wallace was shot, and he was shot in Laurel, Maryland, and it's in Maryland that the unaccountable money is. Yet we know that Artie Bremmer was up in Canada. He took airplane flights around the country. He stayed at an expensive hotel in Maryland. Like James Earl Ray, he had unaccountable money, important money. So what you see in the comparison to Nazi Germany that I began in the star of this tape is that men that are investigating, like U.S. Attorney Robert Meyer and Robert Crown, are dead. Recipients of the money, such as the Maryland money, are dead. Ken Reitz never gets exposure. Evel Younger should never have been allowed to be anything more than the district attorney in Los Angeles after he covered the Robert Kennedy assassination investigation. He should never move up to being the governor of this state, and certainly he should not have been the attorney general. Lewis Tackwood talked about the exposure of these men at the criminal conspiracy section, and we'll go do more about that on the other side of this tape. The criminal conspiracy section of the Los Angeles Police Department is that dangerous network that is linked to the Gestapo, the intelligence community of the Pentagon that has caused so much bloodshed and crime throughout the state of California and is linked to the criminal intelligence throughout the state of California. If I had a staff of workers and a computer or 8 or 10 people just cross-filing the articles that I have, it would really be a real revealing saga of the era. But unfortunately, I'm doing this alone. And so as I come to all of these various deaths that can hardly be coincidence, I think you can see why I make the strong statements that I do about such people as Evel Younger. On the next side of this tape, I'm going to talk about the Glass House Tapes, the book by Lewis Tackwood and the criminal conspiracy section of the Los Angeles Police Department as formed by Evel Younger.